Chapter 10. Why, surely you know. Your friend, Farmer Springrove, the cider maker, and who keeps the three tranters in, who recommended you to me when he came in to see me the other day. Cytherea's mother wit suddenly warned her in the midst of her excitement that it was necessary not to betray the secret of her love. Oh yes, she said, of course. Her thoughts had run as follows in that short interval. Farmer Springrove is Edward's father, and his name is Edward too. Edward knew I was going to advertise for a situation of some kind. He watched the Times, and saw it, my address being attached. He thought it would be excellent for me to be here, that we might meet whenever he came home. He told his father that I might be recommended as a lady's maid, and he knew my brother and myself. His father told Mrs. Morris. Mrs. Morris told Miss Aldcliffe. The whole chain of incidents that drew her there was plain, and there was no such thing as chance in the matter. It was all Edward's doing. The sound of a bell was heard. Cytherea did not heed it, and still continued in her reverie. That's Miss Aldcliffe's bell, said Mrs. Morris. I suppose it is, said the young woman placidly. Well, it means that you must go up to her, the matron continued, in a tone of surprise. Cytherea felt a burning heat come over her, mingled with a sudden irritation at Mrs. Morris's hint. But the good sense which had recognized stern necessity prevailed over rebellious independence. The flush passed, and she said hastily, yes, yes, of course, I must go to her, when she pulls the bell, whether I want to or no. However, in spite of this painful reminder of her new position in life, Cytherea left the apartment in a mood far different from the gloomy sadness of 10 minutes previous. The place felt like home to her now. She did not mind the pettiness of her occupation, because Edward evidently did not mind it, and this was Edward's own spot. She found time on her way to Miss Aldcliffe's dressing room to hurriedly glide out by a side door, and look for a moment at the unconscious sheep bearing the friendly initials. She went up to them to try to touch one of the flock, and felt vexed that they all stared skeptically at her kind advances, and then ran pell-mell down the hill. Then, fearing anyone should discover her childish movements, she slipped indoors again, and ascended the staircase, catching glimpses, as she passed, of silver-buttoned footmen, who flashed about the passages like lightning. Miss Aldcliffe's dressing room was an apartment which, on a casual survey, conveyed an impression that it was available for almost any purpose save the adornment of the feminine person. In its hours of perfect order, nothing pertaining to the toilet was visible. Even the inevitable mirrors with their accessories were arranged in a roomy recess not noticeable from the door, lighted by a window of its own, called the dressing window. The washing stand figured as a vast oak chest, carved with grotesque Renaissance ornament. The dressing table was in appearance something between a high altar and a cabinet piano, the surface being richly worked in the same style of semi-classic decoration, but the extraordinary outline having been arrived at by an ingenious joiner and decorator from the neighboring town, after months of painful toil in cutting and fitting, under Miss Aldcliffe's immediate eye, the materials being the remains of two or three old cabinets the lady had found in the lumber room. About two-thirds of the floor was carpeted, the remaining portion being laid with parquetry of light and dark woods. Miss Aldcliffe was standing at the larger window, away from the dressing niche. She bowed, and said pleasantly, I am glad you have come. We shall get on capitally, I dare say. Her bonnet was off. Cytherea did not think her so handsome as on the earlier day. The queenliness of her beauty was harder and less warm. But a worse discovery than this was that Miss Aldcliffe, with the usual obliviousness of rich people to their dependents' specialities, seemed to have quite forgotten Cytherea's inexperience, and mechanically delivered up her body to her handmaid without a thought of details, and with a mild yawn. Everything went well at first. The dress was removed, stockings and black boots were taken off, and silk stockings and white shoes were put on. Miss Aldcliffe then retired to bathe her hands and face, and Cytherea drew breath. If she could get through this first evening, all would be right. She felt that it was unfortunate that such a crucial test for her powers as a birthday dinner should have been applied on the threshold of her arrival, but set to again. Miss Aldcliffe was now arrayed in a white dressing gown, and dropped languidly into an easy chair, pushed up before the glass. The instincts of her sex and her own practice told Cytherea the next movement. She let Miss Aldcliffe's hair fall about her shoulders, and began to arrange it. It proved to be all real, a satisfaction. Miss Aldcliffe was musingly looking on the floor, and the operation went on for some minutes in silence. At length her thoughts seemed to turn to the present, and she lifted her eyes to the glass. "Why, what on earth are you doing with my head?" " she exclaimed, with widely opened eyes. At the words she felt the back of Cytherea's little hand tremble against her neck. "Perhaps you prefer it done the other fashion, madam?" said the maiden. No, that's the fashion right enough, but you must make more show of my hair than that, or I shall have to buy some, which God forbid. It is how I do my own," said Cytherea naively, and with a sweetness of tone that would have pleased the most acrimonious under favorable circumstances. But tyranny was in the ascendant with Miss Aldcliffe at this moment, and she was assured of palatable food for her vice by having felt the trembling of Cytherea's hand. "Yours, indeed. Your hair. Come, go on." Considering that Cytherea possessed at least 5 times as much of that valuable auxiliary to woman's beauty as the lady before her, there was at the same time some excuse for Miss Aldcliffe's outburst. She remembered herself, however, and said more quietly, "Now then, Gray, by the by, what do they call you downstairs?" "Mrs. Gray," said the handmaid. "Then tell them not to do any such absurd thing, not, but that it is quite according to usage, but you are too young yet." This dialogue tided Cytherea safely onward through the hairdressing till the flowers and diamonds were to be placed upon the lady's brow. Cytherea began arranging them tastefully, and to the very best of her judgment. "That won't do," said Miss Aldcliffe harshly. "Why?" "I look too young and old dressed all." "Will that, madam?" "No, I look a fright, a perfect fright." "This way, perhaps?" "Heavens! Don't worry me so." She shut her lips like a trap. Having once worked herself up to the belief that her headdress was to be a failure that evening, no cleverness of Cytherea's in arranging it could please her. She continued in a smoldering passion during the remainder of the performance, keeping her lips firmly closed, and the muscles of her body rigid. Finally, snatching up her gloves, and taking her handkerchief and fan in her hand, she silently sailed out of the room, without betraying the least consciousness of another woman's presence behind her. Cytherea's fears that at the undressing this suppressed anger would find a vent, kept her on thorns throughout the evening. She tried to read, she could not. She tried to sew, she could not. She tried to muse, she could not do that connectedly. If this is the beginning, what will the end be? She said in a whisper, and felt many misgivings as to the policy of being over hasty in establishing an independence at the expense of congruity with a cherished past. 3. Midnight, the clock struck 12. The Aldcliffe state dinner was over. The company had all gone, and Miss Alcliffe's bell rang loudly and jerkingly. Cytherea started to her feet at the sound, which broke in upon the fitful sleep that had overtaken her. As he had been sitting drearily in her chair waiting minute after minute for the signal, her brain in that state of intentness which takes cognizance of the passage of time as a real motion without matter the instant's throbbing past in the company of a feverish pulse. As he hastened to the room, to find the lady sitting before the dressing shrine, illuminated on both sides, and looking so queenly in her attitude of absolute repose, that the younger woman felt the awfulest sense of responsibility at her vandalism in having undertaken to demolish so imposing a pile. The lady's jeweled ornaments were taken off in silence, some by her own listless hands, some by Cytherea's. Then followed the outer stratum of clothing. The dress being removed, Cytherea took it in her hand, and went with it into the bedroom adjoining, intending to hang it in the wardrobe. But on second thoughts, in order that she might not keep Miss Alcliffe waiting a moment longer than necessary, she flung it down on the first resting place that came to hand, which happened to be the bed, and re-entered the dressing room with the noiseless footfall of a kitten. She paused in the middle of the room. She was unnoticed, and her sudden return had plainly not been expected. During the short time of Cytherea's absence, Miss Alcliffe had pulled off a kind of chemisette of Brussels net, drawn high above the throat, which as he had worn with her evening dress as a semi-opaque covering to her shoulders, and in its place had put her nightgown round her. Her right H, and was lifted to her neck, as if engaged in fastening her nightgown. But on a second glance Miss Alcliffe's proceeding was clearer to Cytherea. She was not fastening her nightgown. It had been carelessly thrown round her, and Miss Alcliffe was really occupied in holding up to her eyes some small object that she was keenly scrutinizing. And now on suddenly discovering the presence of Cytherea at the back of the apartment, instead of naturally continuing or concluding her inspection, she desisted hurriedly. The tiny snap of a spring was heard, her hand was removed, and she began adjusting her robes. Modesty might have directed her hasty action of unwrapping her shoulders, but it was scarcely likely, considering Miss Alcliffe's temperament, that as he had all her life been used to a maid, Cytherea's youth, and the elder lady's marked treatment of her, as if she were a mere child or plaything. The matter was too slight to reason about, and yet upon the whole it seemed that Miss Alcliffe must have a practical reason for concealing her neck. With a timid sense of being an intruder, Cytherea was about to step back and out of the room, but at the same moment Miss Alcliffe turned, saw the impulse, and told her companion to stay, looking into her eyes, as if as he had half an intention to explain something. Cytherea felt certain it was the little mystery of her late movements. The other withdrew her eyes. Cytherea went to fetch the dressing gown, and wheeled round again, to bring it up to Miss Alcliffe, who had now partly removed her nightdress to put it on the proper way, and still sat with her back towards Cytherea. Her neck was again quite open and uncovered, and though hidden from the direct line of Cytherea's vision, she saw it reflected in the glass the fair white surface, and the inimitable combination of curves between throat and bosom which artists adore, being brightly lit up by the light burning on either side. And the lady's prior proceedings were now explained in the simplest manner. In the midst of her breast, like an island in a sea of pearl, reclined an exquisite little gold locket, embellished with arabesque work of blue, red, and white enamel. That was undoubtedly what Miss Alcliffe had been contemplating, and, moreover, not having been put off with her other ornaments, it was to be retained during the night, a slight departure from the custom of ladies which Miss Alcliffe had at first not cared to exhibit to her new assistant, though now, on further thought, she seemed to have become indifferent on the matter. "My dressing gown," apostrophe she said, quietly fastening her nightdress as she spoke. Cytherea came forward with it. Miss Alcliffe did not turn her head, but looked inquiringly at her maid in the glass. "You saw what I wear on my neck, I suppose?" She said to Cytherea's reflected face. Yes, madam, I did, said Cytherea to Miss Alcliffe's reflected face. Miss Alcliffe again looked at Cytherea's reflection, as if she were on the point of explaining. Again she checked her resolve, and said lightly, few of my maids discover that I wear it always. I generally keep it a secret, not that it matters much. But I was careless with you, and seemed to want to tell you. You win me to make confidences that... She ceased, took Cytherea's hand in her own, lifted the locket with the other, touched the spring, and disclosed a miniature. It is a handsome face, is it not? She whispered mournfully, and even timidly. It is. But the sight had gone through Cytherea like an electric shock, and there was an instantaneous awakening of perception in her, so thrilling in its presence, as to be well nigh insupportable. The face in the miniature was the face of her own father, younger and fresher than as he had ever known him but her father. Was this the woman of his wild and unquenchable early love? And was this the woman who had figured in the gate man's story as answering the name of Cytherea before her judgment was awake? Surely it was. And if so, here was the tangible outcrop of a romantic and hidden stratum of the past hitherto seen only in her imagination, but as far as her scope allowed, clearly defined there by reason of its strangeness. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.